Chapter 6. Each day for almost 2 months, Charlie and his drum went out with a wagon to different spots in the Virginia countryside, but not always with Silas Gorman. Sometimes drummer boys from other divisions served as his teacher. In going to other parts of the war-torn state, Charlie saw the damage from past fighting in the forms of deserted, shell-marked houses, burned-out tobacco barns, and unplowed fields long gone to weeds. When he was with him, Silas told Charlie what skirmishes had taken place there, if he knew. Charlie liked the other boys he met well enough, and worked hard to learn what he could from them, but he made no real friends among them the way he had with Silas and Jem. His newly made drummer's uniform was indeed splendid, and he always wore his drumsticks at his belt. He found he had natural rhythm, and his swift progress pleased Silas and Captain Mahoney. Keeping the sticks by him constantly, Charlie beat on anything available. Walls, wooden floors, fences, wagon sides, and even once on a sergeant's broad back. In all this time, he still scarcely knew Tom Fallon, the bugler. There was very little forthcoming from the boy. Charlie wondered if Tom's silence was due to the fact that he stuttered. It was hard for him to get words out. Silas said that Tom talked with his trumpet, not his mouth. In the weeks Charlie spent learning his job in the Army, he saw Jem Miller 2 more times, each time between tattoo and taps. Jem, a corporal now, was as pleasant as always, and ever glad to see him. One time only, the boy saw Con Sullivan, and that time was ugly. Driving out in a wagon to practice with a 3rd Division drummer boy, Charlie spotted Con standing under an oak with soldiers holding muskets with fixed bayonets surrounding him. Con himself was weaponless. The drummer boy stopped the wagon and told Charlie that soldier's going to get punished. "Is he?" "You bet. I bet he cussed out an officer or stole something. Let's watch it." Seated next to the other lad, Charlie looked on as Sullivan's arms were jerked up by 2 burly soldiers, and ropes were fastened around his hands and fingers. The ropes were thrown over the low limb of the tree, and Con was pulled up until he stood on his tiptoes only, with his weight on his thumbs. The other drummer said matter-of-factly, "Strung up by the thumbs. They'll leave him like that for a while till he learns his lesson." "I know him," Charlie told the boy. "He was with my brother when he got killed at Gettysburg." "Well, don't try to cut him down or you'll get thrashed." "I won't. I didn't say I liked him, did I?" "No. Let's get going." As the 2 drummer boys passed in their wagon, Sullivan spotted Charlie. At the top of his lungs, he yelled, "I see you, Charlie Quinn. Look, you're Phil, you dirty little gutter snipe." After the other drummer boy had clucked to the startled horse to go on, he said, "It appears to me he don't like you either." Charlie answered, "For a fact, he don't. He likes whiskey better than anything else." "He ain't alone here in favorin' whiskey," came from the other boy. That was true. In the short time he'd been with the Army, Charlie had noticed how much gambling went on and how much whiskey made its way into the camp. On the morning of April 17th, Gorman went out again with Charlie, and after putting him through his paces drumming, he said, "You're doing fine. Keep at it. Practice all the time. Beat on anything that'll stand still for you. Sleep with your drum beside you at night, and don't ever go any place without it. I'd say by the 1st of May, you'll be ready to do my old job, even if you ain't ready to play in the brass band at dress parade. Men'll understand what you're beating out. You're a real Jim Dandy. You sure took to this natural-like. It took me 6 months to learn what you know now. And you already know everything you'll need. I'm proud of you, Charlie Quinn." And Charlie blushed with pleasure and joy. That same night, Silas came running to the cabin with important news he'd heard at the hotel. General Meade had sent special orders to Washington, D.C., asking for large supplies of wagons, medicines, and food. To boot, he'd requested 50 rounds of ammunition for every soldier. He wanted every man in his command to have 6 days' ration of food and another 10 days' supply to be carried on wagons. There was also to be 10 days' supply of grain for cavalry and wagon mules and horses. In 3 days' time, Meade wanted to have 4,000 wagons ready to drive off at an hour's notice. "Sure as can be," said Gorman. "We're going to be moving out of Culpeper." "Where to?" asked Charlie. "To where we can find General Lee and his Rebs." "Can I go tell a friend of mine?" Charlie looked to Captain Mahoney now, who was in the room with them.
"Sure. I bet he knows already.
Nothing on earth moves faster than news in an army camp." As the captain had predicted, Jeb Miller already had the news. He was darning one of his socks by lantern light and greeted Charlie with, "I can tell from your face that you heard what happened."
"I sure have. When'll we be leaving?" Not right this minute. Sit down. Charlie sat on a home-fashioned stool facing Jem, who sat on its exact counterpart. Well, when will we go? He repeated. When the generals decide. When we're told to cook enough meat for several days' eating, clean our muskets well, and be sure to have 40 rounds of cartridges in our cartridge boxes, and the other 10 in our pockets or knapsacks. That's when we'll be moving out. We'll have a dress parade, too, and a message or speech from a general. How do you feel about going off to fight, Charlie? I wish I was a real soldier, not just a drummer boy. Well, you'll be learning about war anyhow. Don't expect to like it. You know what the soldiers say war is like. No, what? It's four parts waiting, four parts blundering about, and three parts marching and fighting. Let me tell you a few things you ought to know. Sure, you tell us, Jem, came from a soldier lounging on a blanket a few feet away from Charlie. You don't need to know, Jess. You were at Gettysburg, Jem retorted, then went on to Charlie. Well, Charlie, some men see fighting one way, some see it another. I'm a religious man. I think that every battle I come through is God's purpose for me. If he wants me to come through it, I will. Other men will tell you each one of us has got a set time to die. That could be in a battle. Now that ain't what I think, Jem, volunteered Jess. A thick-bodied man with heavy dark brows. I think every fight I come through makes it all the more likely I'll get killed or wounded in the next one. This made Jem say, I was about to get to that. That's what most soldiers think. Charlie asked, then if I'm going into my first fight, I ought to be all right, huh? Do Confederates fire at drummer boys? Jess grinned. Bullets ain't particular about who they hit, kid. All the Johnny Rebs ain't sharp shooters. One of 'em could aim at the color bearer of the 140th and hit somebody else. But ain't you supposed to pick out one enemy and aim at him? Asked Charlie. That's what the officers tell us. But when the fightin' gets hot, you forget things. You just flop down on your back, tear off cartridges with your teeth, and reload your musket. Roll over and shoot some more, even if it's only at smoke rolling towards you, and hope you live through it. Jess, there's no call to scare the boy here. As Jem put down the mended sock, he told Charlie. More soldiers in this man's army die from sickness than battles. Bear that in mind. Thank God there ain't no malaria in Culpeper. But what do you think will happen next, Jem? We'll just sit here on our hunkers and wait and see. While Charlie Quinn fretted at the delay, Meade's great army waited, going about its daily routine, until the first days of May came and the white-flowered dogwood trees bloomed. On the first day of the month, the whole encampment knew they would soon be on the march. On the second, when the march order was actually given, an Ohio regiment mutinied, refusing to go, and General Meade threatened that any soldier who refused to do his duty would be shot without a trial. Everyone, including Charlie Quinn, knew that Meade and Grant intended to march out on the night of the 3rd, with cavalry heading out first to the south and then the east. Behind the cavalry would come the marching men, cannon and supply trains. They would cross the Rapidan River, pass as swiftly as possible through the wilderness on its plank roads, and attack the rebels on Lee's right flank before a full-scale battle began. While they stood in the warm afternoon sunlight of the 3rd, after a dress parade, General Meade reviewed them on his horse, Baldy. Later, he sent a brief message to be read to all the troops. Charlie remembered one sentence particularly well and thought of Johnny as he heard it. Bear with patience the hardships and sacrifices you will be called upon to endure. Keep your ranks on the battlefield. Oh, yes, his brother had done those things. Later that day, Colonel Ayers of the 140th cried aloud to his assembled men from his horse, We shall soon enough engage the enemy. Be cool, keep ranks, press forward, let the wounded lie where they are. Others will come for them. Aim low, close steadily, then use your bayonets. Do not disgrace your state. If any man runs, I want those behind to shoot him. If they don't, I will. As you heard these words, a thrill of pride in the 140th went through Charlie Quinn's soul. A priest had come the night before to his regiment, said mass for those who were Catholic, and heard confessions. Charlie, his newly bestowed drum beside him, confessed his sin of running away from Noreen, and received a penance of prayers. He was also given a rosary of his very own. The priest, a New Yorker, had known Johnny Quinn personally. He spoke highly to Charlie of Johnny's courage. He went on to say that Charlie could make his brother proud of him, even though Johnny was no longer living. How Charlie wished he could write Noreen now that he was about to go into a fight. She'd replied to his letter, saying she was relieved to learn that he was and that to learn where he was and that she hoped he'd take care of himself and keep safe from the rebels. He hadn't replied to it yet. The order to move out came that night. At an hour's notice, several thousand men and a great mass of equipment were to be on their way out of Culpeper. Charlie Quinn, drummer boy of the 140th Veteran Volunteers among them. Silas knew the general's plans to pass through the wilderness in one day's hard marching and give battle later in the open country. The army would leave in the night of May 3rd and 4th with the cavalry leaving the camp first to act as scouts and skirmishers. If any Confederates out scouting were caught, the cavalry would deal with them. After the cavalry, the bridge-building engineers were to leave. Silas came to Charlie late that night to warn him. "Charlie, it's to be a long march, near to 30 miles, I hear. We got a river to cross, too. You'll be mighty tired at the end of all the walking." Charlie boasted, "Don't you worry about me. I can keep up. I may be tired, but I'll get there, too." "Well, then, I won't worry. I'll see you later." Silas flashed a grin in the fading light of the campfires and walked away, every inch the Union Army soldier. Not long afterward, as the 140th stood ready and waiting, the order came from General Griffith to march out of camp to the Culpeper Road that led to Stevensburg. Half running at times to keep up, Charlie Quinn traveled beside the color bearer of the 140th and some of the officers. Before long, the night march ceased to be an adventure to him, as his drum, rations, and equipment began to weigh more and more. Yet, true to his promise to Silas, he kept going, putting one foot in front of the other. On strict orders, the huge army marched as silently as it could. Men, wagons, riders, and even cattle driven along to supply fresh beef later on. When the first two army divisions came to the Rapidan River, they found that the engineers had done their work swiftly and surely. They had erected a bridge of floating canvas pontoons at Germana Ford, so the men could cross over on foot. As Charlie Quinn crossed over two abreast with an officer, he felt as if he were walking on jelly. The pontoon swayed so much that by the time he got onto the Germana Plank Road below the bridge, he was dizzy, and the officer beside him had to grab him to steady him. Soon they entered the 12-by-15-mile wilderness, hated and feared by every man, because all knew the misery it had caused during the lost Battle of Chancellorsville the previous year. All night the 140th and the many other regiments behind them marched along the narrow plank road. There was no singing the lilting "The Girl I Left Behind Me" now, as on the parade ground. There was no shouting of orders. When a courier galloped past, the sound of his horse's hooves was the only warning to make marching men give way. Charlie was ever aware of the thick forest surrounding him. The memory of his first day out drumming with Silas haunted him. How glad he'd be to be out there, out of here. Though there was to be no noise, there was some over-the-night cry of the whippoorwill. How could there be total silence with thousands of men on the move? Through the darkness came the sound of skillets clanking at men's belts, a sneeze or a cough, cursing as some sleepy infantryman fell against the man ahead of him, and always the soft shuffling of feet. Around 4 in the morning, Charlie grew so drowsy and weary that he started to stumble against the color bearer. An officer nearby saw this, grabbed Charlie by the arm and helped him along, then whispered an order to someone behind him who went back at a run. Moments later, Captain Mahoney came up, trotting his horse to the front of the regiment. A long-armed soldier set Charlie's drum and all behind the captain, and from then on the boy dozed with his arms around the captain's waist and his cheek on his back. At noon, Charlie's weary regiment caught up with the Union Army cavalry at a tiny middle-of-the-woods hamlet called Wilderness Tavern. As they rested here, a courier came galloping up to them from General Meade. The 140th and other infantry units were ordered to leave the horse soldiers, turn west, and march down another plank road called the Orange Turnpike. Here, a mile and a half west of the Wilderness Tavern, they were to remain after they had flung a line of sentinels across that road. 2 hours later, Silas came over to Charlie as he sat with his back to a tree beside his drum. "How are you?" Silas asked. "All right, I got a ride partway here." Charlie looked around him at the footsore men, sitting and lying on the ground beside the road. Then he looked at the closely spaced trees and said, "I want to get out of this place, though, Silas." You and me both. I hear we're more than half out of the wilderness. I don't want to look at another tree for a whole year after we get out of here. I wonder where the rebels are.
I don't know. Maybe they don't know where we are yet.
I sure hope they don't. I hear tell we're supposed to stay here and hold this road for a while.
How come we don't just rest a little and go on and get out of here?
Gorman shook his head. The generals make the rules, Charlie. I learned a while back to rest every bit I can. Eat some of your rations. I don't think we'll be making any fires now. I have to get back. Maybe I'll come see you later on.
Sure, Silas.
Charlie reached into his knapsack, took out some meat and hardtack, and chewed joylessly as he kept looking about. He sensed the trees or something in them watching him. He couldn't shake this feeling all day long. As Charlie slept that night in the dark camp, he dreamed near dawn of Johnny. In his dream, the two of them fought against a howling throng of dead rabbits. He and Johnny were getting the worst of it.